Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Wrestling Talk with Mayor McCall. I'm your co-host, Willie B. Today we have a very, very special guest, and as always, here to introduce him is my tag team partner. He's the founder, promoter, booker of the stars, the CEO of our humble podcast, Mayor McCall.
Willie B, you're not gonna believe who I got on this episode. He is a wrestling legend known all over the world. He has held the Southern Tag Team title, three-time AWA International Heavyweight Champion, and the longest reigning CWA Heavyweight Champion, 127 days. He is in the Memphis Wrestling Hall of Fame. Ladies and gentlemen, wrestling legend Phil Hickerson.
Welcome to the show, Phil.
Hey, guys. How y'all doing?
We are doing well. It's an honor to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you what, I've been looking forward to this. And you know what, guys? This is the first one that I've done and our first interview since I've been out of the business. So it's wow. Sort of an honor.
It's an honor to be on the show. The honor is all ours. The honor is all ours to have the legendary Phil Hickerson on our favorite Memphis wrestling podcast. It's truly an honor, sir.
And I had no idea that this was the first, you know, it was exclusive for our show. I had no idea this was the first interview you had done since you got out of the business. So I'm super stoked at this point.
Yeah.
Well, tell us well, a little bit about how you got in the business back in the day.
Back how I got in the business?
Yes, sir. How did you get in the business?
Well, I was at Owens Corning here in Jackson, Tennessee.
Yep.
I was driving a forklift for the utility department. There was a guy that come up that was in a security guard, and he had a wrestling ring in his backyard. And he said, "Why don't you come over and let's get in the ring and just, you know, clown around a little bit." I said, "Well, all right." So I went over that night, and I didn't know what I was doing. But we had a little fun doing it, and so that sort of got my interest in it. There was a local guy here, well, I say guy, LaVon Stone, which has passed away now. I knew him, and he wrestled, and you can look him up. You know that the old school. I remember when I was a kid, I used to watch him, that he was training people in Union City.
Where Coco Beware's from. The same place where Coco Beware was from, Union City, Tennessee.
Okay, no. All right, wait a minute. I jumped ahead of myself. LaVon was training here in Jackson at a boys' club. And I went over there, and I had several lessons from him, if you want to call it that. And then we heard that there was a group of guys in Union City, Tennessee, that would meet up there every Sunday afternoon. And so we drove up there and got in the ring with them guys and really got me interested in it. And then... that's back when you had to have license to wrestle.
Through the State Athletic Commission.
You had to have a license through the Athletic Commission?
Right, through the commission and everything. So I went to Nashville and met Nick Newlis, got my license, and I come back. And so, naturally, you know, you get booked on some of the towns that Nick had, and which, as a part-timer, didn't pay too well, and a lot of long trips. So, and then I got the fortune enough to be on Memphis TV, and I, the whole time I was doing that, I was progressing pretty good, and... and so J.J., Eddie Marlin, and all of them sort of took notice on it. And so they started booking me a little bit more. And then booking some of the smaller towns that was close that I could make by, because I was still working, still driving this forklift. And so I was sitting there in my living room floor, and I was playing with my son. He was a little old tot, and the phone rang, and the wife answered it and said, "Yes, wait a minute." And I said, "Who is it?" Just like I always do. "Who is it?" She said, "Jerry Jarrett." And I said, "What?" So I got on the phone with him, and he said, "Want to know if I could come to Memphis," just like that. And I said, "For what?" And he said, "To wrestle tonight." And I said, "Tonight?" I said, "I'm not on the card." Just I was still about a half mark.
Sure.
And so he said, "You forget." He said, "I'm booking this thing." And he said, "I got a little something in mind." I said, "Okay." So, boy, we packed the bags right quick, and boy, and off I went. Well, I got to Memphis, and of course, that's with the guys in there, you know, "Hey, what are you doing here, kid?" You know, like that, you know. Well, what Jerry Jarrett saw is that Al Green had needed a partner. And so they put me in there with Al as a partner that night. And it was more or less just a throw in. And so it's sort of, Al was the main brawler. I was the bump taker. You know what they call it? They threw me all around the ring. And so it just sort of clicked. Well, Al lost his hair to Jackie Fargo in Memphis. And I lost my hair in Jonesboro to Eddie Marlin. And I would now remember, I'm still part-timing. And when they looked at us, they said, "Wow, this is unreal." So that's when they really put us together. So Al come to me in the dressing room, and he said, "Hick," he said, "they're going to call you up there," and he said, "they're going to ask you to go full time, and how much money is it going to take?" And he said, "I'm going to tell you. Now, I'm not going to say it, you know, how much they offered, and I'm not going to say how much I took. But he told me, he says, gave me some advice, don't take less than this, but don't overprice yourself too." So I didn't. They took it. And I told them, I said, "I've got a job. I've got to do something. I've got to give a little notice." And I said, "When's the next book?" And he said, "Tomorrow night." And I said, "Where?" And he said, "Louisville, Kentucky." I said, "Hell, I can't make Louisville, Kentucky and still work." And so, well, bottom line is that I went on and I went back to work, and I told him, I said, "I'd like to have a 30-day leave of absence." And I said, "I'm going to try this professional wrestling." Well, they thought I was nuts. And I said, "The way it is," I said, "if I don't make it the first 2 weeks or something like that," I said, I'll let you know. And I said, "I'll come back real quick." And so I remember that I worked 4 days. Now we're talking about 69, 68, 69, 70, somewhere along in there. And I remember that's when they paid you in a little envelope, paid you cash, matter of fact. And I remember I got my money, I come home, and that 4 days that I sat there with me and my wife sitting there at the kitchen table, and I spread all these $100 bills out. And we absolutely thought we was rich.
Well, you were back then.
I'm going to tell you. I made $1,100 in 4 days. And that was back then. And me and the wife, we were just in tears. Now, we didn't have, you know, we were just an average family, you know, living in a little two-bedroom house, two kids, and didn't have a whole lot, working payday to payday. And so, like I said, we thought we was absolutely rich. Well, I got up the next morning, and I called Fiberglass to call my boss, and I told him, I said, I won't be back. He said, well, it's been a week. And I said, that's right. And I said, I'm not coming back. I said, I'm going to stay with it full time. And they put me, naturally, I was with Al. And by me being a young, no more than 6 months in the business, and then put me with Al Green. And Al always been a top contender, and always name was been up there. And I got a lot of heat from the boys, simply because, oh, look at that young punk, you know, they're making the money and stuff like that, and he ain't really got his ears wet. And so I got a lot of heat for that, but I think I earned the respect from them for the work that I did. And I tried to put 110% in, and it paid off. I made a name. So when Al retired and left me out there, then I went through several partners, and then Sam Bass managed me. And so, you know, it's been a pretty good career.
I want to, before we, you know, I want to discuss Al Green as well. You and Al Green were phenomenal together. Y'all had some success. Y'all were the Southern Tag Team Champions. Y'all had some legendary feuds with Jerry Lawler and Tojo Yamamoto. Talk to us about, right, you know, that feud.
Timmy, what, sir?
I was saying that, you know, you and Al had, you know, tremendous success. Y'all are phenomenal together. Y'all, you know, won the Southern Tag Team titles. You had a great feud with Jerry Lawler and Tojo Yamamoto. What are your memories of that feud and working with them?
Working with them?
Yes, sir.
Oh, boy. Well, what can you say? Lawler is Lawler. Man, I'm telling you, what a mind. What a wrestling mind. And same way with Tojo. Tojo had a, you know, he was mean, tough. And we had some good matches. I know on mine that with me and Lawler hooking up with each other, we did a lot of, as they call them, high spots. And we did a lot of high spots. Of course, Al and Tojo would be more or less the strong arm. But the two combinations. And it really worked. And it was believable. We made everything believable. That was the key to it. You know, if you throw a punch, like you're gonna kill somebody.
Absolutely.
That's the way it was back then. You know, you did high spots, they call it, you know. Well, you look at it today. They do it. Back then, you could pull somebody's hair. And you could almost have people coming out of the seats. You don't do that these days. I mean, you know, they got people jumping off the top ropes, doing somersaults and everything else, where back when I, you know, we were in it and everything, that was a finish. I mean, you beat somebody if you did something like that. And now it's just an everything, you know, it's so much different. That's the reason why you hear a lot of people say that they'd rather have the old school type wrestling.
Amen.
And I believe it.
Same here.
I'm going to tell you, I don't watch it. I haven't watched it in, what, 100 years? Yeah. And only time we'll catch somebody when they'll say something, we hear somebody like Tommy Rich. We'll hear his name or somebody's name that we've that I've worked against and stuff like that, we might. But if it's somewhere along down the card, nah, we won't watch it. You know, I ain't gonna mess with it. But I'm glad I come up into the part, the era, you say, that I did. And like I said, I put 110% in it. It helped me, and also it hurt me. And it helped me making Phil Hickerson the name. But it also hurt me with my family. And we were gone. We did a lot of traveling. And I missed a lot of growing up with my kids. And I missed a lot of, you know, what time with my wife. And that's one thing that you cannot get back. No. And the amount of traveling, 3,000 to 4,000 miles a week, and sometimes being gone a week, 2 weeks, and even a month, and seeing them just when you can. So it's and I miss that. I really, really do. I mean, I know them. They're sitting around there talking, and I'm sitting in the dark because I don't know what. They went to a recital. They went here. They went there. I didn't know anything about it because I was wrestling, stuck in a motel room, and then, you know, hit the next town, talked to them on the phone, and then until you got back in. So,
It's refreshing to hear to hear you talk about the sacrifices that it took for you to be a professional wrestler. That's a common theme and a common story within the industry. But to hear you talk about we can tell how much you love your family. But so thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't take nothing for them. And I don't think anybody would, but it is a big burden, especially on the wife, because she's the mama, the daddy, and while you're gone, and it's a lot of burden on him, and it's her. And tell you the truth, that's the reason why a lot of marriages don't last, is because being gone so much, and it just takes its toll on the marriage, but mine survived, and I'm thankful for that.
Speaking of traveling, I talked to our good buddy Downtown Bruno last week. Was his birthday, and he was our first ever guest we ever had, and he said that you're his favorite ever travel partner.
Well, that's nice. I'm telling you what, I had a lot of laughs with Bruno. I'm telling you, I love that guy. Matter of fact, me and the wife adopted him. You know, he'll call me daddy, and he calls my wife Anita mother, and so we've had a lot of laughs. We've had Thanksgiving dinners, we've had everything else together right here in my home, and like I said, I love him just like my son, and I used to call him my son. And I'll give you a funny thing. I was wrestling Bill Dundee, and Bruno was management. I forget what town it was, but I mean, it's immaterial. But anyway, Bruno did a little deal on the outside. Well, Dundee went after him. And here they go running around the ring. I'm standing up in the ring just watching them run the circle. And about that time, Bruno bails into the ring, runs across the ring. You got to see and picture this, that Dundee is around his tail. And as soon as Bruno was in the ring, Dundee's in the ring, and Bruno runs straight to me and jumps. And when he jumps, I caught him just like a baby, and he's on my hip. And I've got my arm around him, and he's got his arms around my neck. And it does. It looked like somebody's holding a kid. And all the people went crazy. Dundee just lost it when he seen it. You know, he started laughing.
playing the perfect Weasley heel.
I guess, if you sit there, it was the size of Bruno, you know, that little scrawny thing.
Yeah, because you're a big fellow and Bruno's on the smaller side.
Brute, and he's holding him like a baby. So you've seen people in the grocery store holding a kid on their hips, you know. And but that's exactly what it is. Boy, I'll remember that the day I die. Is one of the highlights with Bruno. But like I said, I love the guy, man. I'm telling you, I had a lot of fun with him. I enjoyed him managing me, and like I said, a travel partner. Yeah, boy, I wouldn't. He was great.
Well, you're going to get to talk to him soon because I gave Miss Anita his phone number this morning, and he told me to tell you to call him anytime after 7 p.m., and he can't wait to talk to you.
Right. She had told me that she had his number.
Well, we want to surprise you.
Well, good. I'll definitely give him a call.
He'll love that. I heard the excitement in his voice, and I told him we're going to interview you. And he's like, oh, y'all are going to interview Phil? He's like, he was like, I love him and Anita so much. Please make sure you have him contact me. I'm like, Bruno, Phil will be calling you soon. Don't worry, buddy.
Okay.
Speaking of another tag team partner you had, you were with the Bicentennials with Dennis Condrey. What are some of your memories working with Dennis?
Oh, boy. Let me see. Well, I'm going to start with this. I was in singles. I was wrestling single matches. Dennis, this is when the Tennessee was in two territories. You had your Nashville, Birmingham, Chattanooga, Huntsville, Alabama. That was their major towns on that end. Nick Gulas.
The Gulas end.
More or less. Yeah, the Gulas end, right. And then, of course, down here, you know, Memphis and, you know, Louisville and Evansville and everything else. So
Nashville, Tupelo, Jonesboro.
I wrestled Dennis one time against each other. And I said, wow, boy, what a match. Of course, he was a baby. Baby faced. Well, you know, you didn't see him anymore or anything like that. Didn't think anything of it. Of course, it didn't, you know, I didn't look for it to go any further than just other than just a match. Dennis missed a couple of bookings. And they called him to the office in Nashville. And Nick fired him because he missed the bookings. And let me back up just one thing. In Jackson, Tennessee, where we lived, that I wrestled Dennis, and we went 15-minute draw. That's what they wanted. That's what we gave them. And so they fired Dennis. They're in this big conference room. And so there was George, and there was Nick's goofy son, and then Nick himself, Lynn Rossi, Jerry Jarrett, and Eddie Marlin. All of them was in the conference room. And so all of a sudden, when he got ready to leave, was going to go out the door, Jerry asked him, said, Dennis, let me ask you one question. He said, why did you miss them bookings? And he just looked at him, and he said, sir, he said, I'm going to tell you, he said, I didn't have the money to make the bookings, make the town. And he said, I've ate popcorn for 2 days. He told Jerry Jarrett that. And Jerry Jarrett stood up then and told Nick, he said, I'm not going to fire him. He said, I don't want you to fire him. He said, I got something I think will work. And so he stuck us together. And boy, it clicked. They put us together. They sent us to old Nick's Inn and told us to go down there and get it together. We'll bring you back. Well, we went down there. 2 weeks later, we were back. We already had it together. I don't know what it was, but there was something there that I could look at him and he could look at me, and we just knew what the other one was going to do. And it was amazing.
Natural chemistry.
Yeah. And I'm telling you, he was a hell of a partner. He was a good partner. Dennis Russell boy could wrestle too. So it just more or less, we just clicked. And so we got a lot of heat. We made them money. They made us some money. Everybody was happy. And what I think we was together, 5 years on? Something like that? Yeah.
Yeah.
5 years. And so I more or less, got out of it there for a while. And Dennis took on some partners. And then next thing you know that he hooked up with Cornette and the Midnight Express. And boy, that was history for him.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge Midnight Express fan, and I say this all the time that Dennis Condrey is one of the greatest tag team wrestlers that probably ever lived. He was, I mean, truly, and he got to start with you. So, he's by far, the Midnight Express were incredible, and that was more of my time to watch. But they were just, he's just one of the best ever.
Phil, what was working with Dennis? What was one of your most maybe memorable or favorite feuds that you and Dennis had with another team?
That we worked against?
Yes, sir.
Wrestle against? Oh boy, there's been so many. The Gibsons.
Okay.
We had some fantastic matches with them. Boy, you put me on the spot here.
Like, sorry about that.
No, we had a. Let's see. I'm trying to think for the long run. Boy, you got me.
I'm gonna pull one out of the hat you might hadn't heard in a while. You and Dennis against Big Red and Bearcat Brown.
Yeah, boy, yeah.
That took place on Monday night at the Mid-South Coliseum, January 23rd of
1978. I can't hear it.
Wow. It's on one of our posters
here in our studio. It's one of our favorite posters that we have. It's a wrestling program from back then that John had made into a poster that we have.
Yeah.
So that's one of our we look at it every day. So we get to actually finally get to ask you about that match. It's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, back at and Big Red.
Man,
oh man,
that card was actually headlined by Lawler against Jimmy Valiant, hair versus hair, for the Southern Heavyweight title.
Yeah, but see, I don't even remember that. Now that just, what I mean? There's been so many matches.
Do you have any matches in general that stick out to you that maybe stick out more than others at any time in your career?
Any matches?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. With Harley Race.
Ah. The greatest wrestler on God's green earth. as he calls himself.
I'm telling you what. It was our more in the ring with him than anybody. What a fantastic. Just this guy was phenomenal. He really was. He was so smooth. It was like portrait motion.
Yeah.
And it was and a super guy to me. Now, I've heard stories, you know, of him being a little rough on some of them, but to me, it was always, I think he respected me, and I respected him a lot. And like I said, I had matches, and as a matter of fact, I won a match over him in my hometown there in Jackson. So that was a heck of a privilege. He didn't have to do that, but he did.
And that's cool. That's awesome.
You wanted to have a parade after that match, didn't you, Phil?
Woo! I was walking on cloud nine, man. Let me tell you.
There's not. I mean, you think about it. There's not very many men that can say they got to. They got one. Over, they got to, that Harley Race put them over
in their hometown.
In their hometown, that you got to win over Harley Race in your hometown. That's pretty right. Damn cool. That's pretty cool, man.
Man, I'll tell you what, everywhere I went, I mean, people, that was the talk, you know, so right there, especially there in Jackson. And but I had some good matches. Terry Taylor was one of them. I had some good matches with him, not only in my hometown, but also there at the Coliseum in Memphis.
You had won the AWA International Heavyweight Championship from Terry Taylor twice in 85.
That's right. That's right. And Terry Taylor was a good stepping stone for me, you might say.
Also that year, you won the title from the Mongolian Stomper. What are your memories of him?
Woo, boy. Woo-hoo. The Stomper.
Mongolian Stomper.
Yep. Oh, Archie Goldner. And there's another guy that I beat him in Jackson. And he come all the way from Knoxville, Tennessee.
I'm seeing a pattern with this in Jackson, Tennessee. This something's rigged up there.
Yeah.
You don't want to wrestle Phil Hickerson in Jackson, Tennessee, because you're gonna leave a loser. That's what I see. You don't wanna fight Phil Hickerson in his hometown.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. But Archie, the Stomper, what a convincing type of guy. He could look at you and look at the audience, and hell, he could scare them just looking at him. If I'm not mistaken, I think he was Canadian, actual Canadian, but it was a good theme for him, you want to say.
Let the audience know what a true wrestling legend and everything you are, Phil. You know, speaking of the AWA International Heavyweight Championship that you won three times in 85, I want to tell the audience some of the other people that have actually held that title. Austin Idol, Jerry Lawler, Stan Hansen, Randy Savage, Tommy Rich, Eddie Gilbert, Bill Dundee, the Raging Bull, Manny Fernandez, and the list goes on and on and on. So what a huge honor to, you know, have been the AWA International Heavyweight Champion.
Yeah. It was sweet. it was great. It was quite an honor. And it's stuff that, you know, cherished the rest of my life.
Also, another big honor you had, 1988, you won the CWA heavyweight title, and actually you hold the record. You have the longest reign at 127 days.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody holds that record but Phil Hickerson. 127 days, the longest reign in CWA heavyweight champion in history, ladies and gentlemen.
I had a good run then, didn't I? 127 days. A lot of matches in that, because they throw everybody at me, and every chance they got. So that's quite an honor, 127 days.
Please correct me if I'm wrong. I can't remember everything, but I want to say that you had beat Max Payne for that title. Is that correct, or was that somebody else?
Max Payne.
Okay.
You know, he was a big guy, a lot bigger than I was and everything, but I beat him. That was the main thing. Went back out on the, of course, naturally you're going to get a rematch. And that's the time that you'll hear a lot of people say that on Memphis TV is when I referred to him as Maxi Pad. And I said, I don't know why. I think it come out at something like, I don't know why they call him Max Payne. I said, they should call him Maxi Pad. And boy, that stuck. Matter of fact, Dave Brown just lost it. It was only like, if I'm mistaken, I beat him, got the title, had a rematch, beat him, and that was the end of it. There wasn't no more, you know, as far as working with him, and then we moved on, and I kept it there for a long time.
That was a huge year for Memphis Wrestling. You know, 1988, that's the year that Lawler, you know, defeated Curt Hennig for the AWA World title, and later that year, mm-hmm. you know, Superclass yep. 3, they united the title was unified when he defeated Kerry Von Erich. What do you think? Why do you think they kept the title on you that long for 127 days?
Do that again.
Why do you think they, you know, kept the title on you so long, you know, for 127 days?
Because I was invincible.
There you go.
I was rough, tough. They knew they could throw anybody at me, and I could have a match with them.
Yep.
I could make them money, and that's what they're interested in, is people that they can make money with. They wanted a person that had the belt, that people would come and see them try to beat you for the belt. And they would pay that money. And they didn't do it for 127 days.
Yep. Because that's during the time that Lawler was gone and traveling with the belt. And so to have Phil Hickerson there to be the man, to be the champion, was, you're correct. You put butts in the seats, and that's what mattered.
Yeah. That's it. And then later on, you know, you find out, you know, you're not necessarily, hell, you're a number. You're a number to them. I don't care who you are. You're a number. If you can't make them money, your number's gone.
If you can't grow, you got to go.
That's right. And they're going to keep calling your number. And I was lucky they kept calling my number.
I know you did some work, you know, with All Japan Pro Wrestling, you know, with Jerry Blackwell. Y'all teamed up. You know, what was it like working in Japan?
Oh, man, that's an all different ball game right there.
That's what we hear.
Yeah. When I was over there, let me see. There was Jimmy Snuka, Tommy Rich, Stan Hansen, Johnny Ace, Spivey, Abdullah the Butcher, and Tiger Singh, I think that's how it is. That was the one that was over. That was the only Americans. We had a bus all to ourselves. Then all the Japanese guys, you know, they had their own. We were there for 30 days, and it was sweet. Money was great. The only thing that it cost you was what you ate after the matches, if you wanted that. Everything else was paid for. Ticket, airline tickets, you know, your transportation, and they would tell you what time to be on the bus, and boy, you better be there. But what I loved it, your matches started anywhere from 4 to 6 o'clock. That's when they had it, and so boy, you had the rest of the night. And I don't know. And you wrestled the Japanese guys. Well, they had several top contenders over there, top guys. With me and Blackwell was together, naturally, in the tag team tournament. And you had matches, and whoever won the most matches won the tournament. Well, naturally, me and Jerry, we didn't win enough matches to win the tournament. But we wrestled against Baba and all of them. There was a lot of guys coming up, and boy, let me tell you, they had to impress Baba, impress the higher up, and I left there with a lot of marks on me. They
shoot style.
I mean, you could see shoelaces across my chest, my back, and everybody is. It's like I said, it's a different ball game over there. But what really surprised you? You know, people, you know how people go nuts here over wrestling, right? Well, here it is. You do a high spot, okay? And people go crazy. In Japan, this is exactly what it is right here. Did you get that?
Yep, taking slaps on the chest and taking real shoot style.
That's it.
Yeah.
No screaming, no nothing. It was
the fans are quiet.
They're very quiet
during matches. They do the same thing with mixed martial arts matches. They'll cheer. They'll cheer at certain points, but they are very quiet and observant during the match.
Yeah. We did get one cheer. We was coming out of the ring. There was four sumo wrestlers sitting there. And I went, Jerry, look at that. He goes, yeah. You know, of course, Jerry had gone over a bunch of times. And he knew it was my first time at that time. And he said, you want to meet him? I said, yeah, just like that. Well, now, we're going back towards the dressing room, right? People are watching. And we go over to them. They stood up. And we stood up. I mean, we were standing rather. I don't know why I said we stood up. But And when I did, I bowed to them. Mm. The people, that's when I got the cheer. It showed them that I respected them.
Yes.
You know, for what they did. And what they did for the wrestling over there for their people, and it just said, "Hey, here's an American over here that, you know, that shows respect to the sumos." It was, I think it was good that I did that. It was quite an honor for me to meet the guys, so it worked out good.
And you and Jerry wasn't, you know, sumo size, but you and Jerry, y'all were probably, you know, one of the biggest, you know, teams in the tournament. You and Jerry were some big guys.
Sure was. And I'm telling you what, you talk about somebody that could do that. Here was a guy that had to be pretty close to 400 pounds. Then they're shaped like a pumpkin. And could drop kick and kick your teeth out. It was amazing what this guy could do. For his size. Now, I was size 2. I could drop kick, but nothing like him. And I mean, he could get up there and like I said, all around good guy. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think he's passed now. So
he passed in 1995. So
that's sad. Boy, you know your history.
Yes, sir. We try to look him up and get as much as we can. Yes, sir.
Well, people ought to stay with you. I'm going to tell you, because if they want to know something about old school wrestling, you guys have got it.
Well, hey, that's such an honor coming from you. Actually, as of yesterday, we were number 9 all of all wrestling podcasts. we were top 100 in the United States and Ireland. We broke the top 100 in both countries.
Oh, that's great. Well, congratulations.
So thank you, Phil. And just to let you know that we're streaming in about 17 countries, so everybody's going to be hearing about Phil Hickerson.
Oh, good. Now, how does somebody, say if somebody wants to get in there, how do they get in there to you?
How do they get the podcast, John? Explain. You go to Apple.
Well, it's our show's call, of course, is Wrestling Talk with Mayor McCall. And we're on all major platforms, Anchor, Spotify, Apple, Google, Podcast Addicts, just any platform you would want to listen to a podcast, we're available. Hell, we're successful enough. You can Google Wrestling Talk with Mayor McCall and we'll come right up. So
okay, yeah, 'cause I've told everybody that I'm sort of associated with, and our pastor was a big wrestling fan, and boy, he always wanted to know some of the stuff, and of course he's a younger guy, and I don't know what y'all's age is, but he's a lot younger than I am.
We're in early 40s. And, early 40s.
Same way with him, and so I was telling him about it. Matter of fact, saw him yesterday, and I told him we was going to do this, and he said, "Be sure to let him know, and how to get to it, because he wanted to hear it." So I told him I would, and guys, I'll tell everybody from here on in.
Well, John will send you a link as soon as we post the show.
It'll be released, later on. But I'll definitely send you a link on Facebook and all, and you and Miss Anita, you'll be able to pull it up.
Yeah. Okay.
You remind me of something too with a big man and such, agility and a drop kick. Did you ever have the chance to work with Bam Bam Bigelow?
Work with who?
Bam Bam Bigelow.
No. I was. I knew when he come into Memphis and everything, and I saw him, and I said, "Boy, if here's a freak as everybody is with flames tattooed on his head, But that guy could work. That guy could work for his size. Hell, anybody go across the ring cartwheeling, and I don't know what he would. He had to go pretty close to 400 pounds.
Oh, but, absolutely.
And a tough guy to start with. I'm trying to think of the guy that trained him, but he did him well, I'll talk to him and all that stuff. He's a super guy in the dressing room. Now I don't know.
I believe he was trained by Larry Sharp, is what I just found on the internet.
That's it. Sure is.
Yep, Larry Sharp.
That's the name. Yep.
What was the place called? Like the Wrestling Factory or something? Or
let's see.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But you do have. That's
Monster Factory, the world famous Monster Factory.
Okay.
Not so much now. You see everything on people's head, different colors.
But for those times, he stood out.
Put flames on a bald head. Oh boy, back then, something else.
Hey, look at that guy.
Yeah, how could you miss him?
Absolutely. Back in your era and your heyday, when you were wrestling, the fans still believe it was before the days of the internet. It was, before anything like that. Fans truly believe. Talk about some of that, that Memphis heat or some of that territorial heat that you got to see firsthand with some of the guys in the crowd. Tell us a good heat story.
Well, one of the things that comes right off my mind is when me and Dennis was together, we was wrestling in Clarksville, Tennessee. And we was in the ring and hadn't actually started the match. And it was cold and it was damp. And about that time, Dennis turned around to me in the ring and he says, "There's a guy sitting over on the front row." He said, "Look at him." And he told me what he was doing. He said, "Look on his lap." and he had a trench coat. And okay, big deal. Now we're in the ring, and we're talking, and he said, "The guy just showed me a pistol." I said, "What?" I said, "You nuts?" He goes, "The guy has got a pistol underneath the trench coat." Well, boy, that got my attention right quick. And I said, "You know, how much heat we're going to get tonight?" And all of a sudden, we got to call the referee over there, and we said, "This guy over here has got a pistol." And I said, "I don't know what his intentions are, but I said, hope it ain't going to be on us." Well, the referee got the policeman, and they went over there, and sure enough, stood him up, and there was the pistol.
Wow.
And boy, they marched him out of there real quick. So, who knows? Boy, that stuck in my mind for a long, long time.
I can imagine. It wasn't referee Jerry Calhoun, was it?
No. No. Hell, Calhoun would probably run sooner we told him. Back to the dressing room.
Calhoun would have took off.
Yeah. So, that's one of the times that that really, really, really did.
What was like one of your favorite territory, like in the territory, what was one of your favorite towns to wrestle in? And don't say Jackson, because we know you kicked everybody's ass that came to Jackson, but besides where did you like to wrestle?
Well, one thing, Memphis, naturally, because that was a good paying town. I don't know. Louisville was good. Louisville was good, although it was, you know, several miles. The weekends, believe it or not, was good. When you got Tupelo, you got Jonesboro. They were good towns. And if you was, of course, Eddie Marlin owned both those towns. And that was basically it. You know, you go to Tupelo, go into Memphis to make TV, and go to Jonesboro. That was your three shots. And make money at all of them. You know, it might have been a smaller venue as far as the, but you could make money. And that was bottom line.
Speaking of making money, nobody got paid for the TV tapings, right? Like Channel 5, Channel 13. Nobody got paid for that, did they?
Certain ones.
Ah, okay. Interesting.
The guys that lost, the jobbers, they paid them something. But as Jerry Jarrett told me one time, that Lawler, Dundee, of course myself, there was a couple of boys in there that names. He said, "You ain't gonna get paid TV." He said, "They're here on Saturdays, and they're not gonna be no any more bookings than Saturdays." He said, "We pay them." He said, "Y'all gonna make y'all's money in Memphis, and you're gonna make it in the big town." He said, "So why are y'all worried about TV?" Of course, they don't. You know, TV don't pay you a lot anyway. So,
well, but TV was the time where you guys were talking the fans into coming to see you in the different towns and at the Coliseum.
Right.
Yeah.
Especially like, you know, our memories. You know, Saturday morning wrestling was really just a build up to Monday night at the Mid-South Coliseum.
Anyways, it was an infomercial to get you to come to the Coliseum on Monday night.
You're going to have to hit me with you again. It slowed down.
I know. I said it was almost like an infomercial just to get the fans to the Coliseum on Monday night. It's a lot of what Saturday TV was.
Exactly. That's what it's all about. You create that interest, and it goes back. They want to see the so-called good guy beat the bad guy up. And so you do stuff on TV to create that. Make them get out of that house, get in the car, and get on down there and buy that ticket.
That's right.
What was it like working with, speaking of TV, what was it like working with to me, the greatest, you know, wrestling commentating team in the history of wrestling, Mr. Lance Russell and Mr. Dave Brown.
Oh, boy. Here is somebody. Of course, you know, Lance was more of the front guy. Dave was Dave. But Lance, he could take a orangutan and make it a good interview, if you get my drift. You never had an interview in your life, and this guy could pull it out of you. He knew what to do, what to say, the actions. And he could put somebody over, and he could take it away from him. I've also, heard, and I've got one guy that I always, every time I see him, and he said, Lance Russell would always say, come on, Phil, you know, when I was in the ring wrestling. Oh, come on, Phil. You know, for good grief. Stuff like that was so convincing. If you didn't have TV watching it, and if you just had the radio on, and if you heard him talking, him and Dave, you could see the match taking place if you was looking straight at the radio. That's how good they were. They were good as a team. And still, in my book, the best announcers has ever been announcing.
We totally agree with that. To me, like, just the look that Lance Russell could have on his face could just make you believe that it was real.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's convincing part of it's a big deal, and boy, he could do it. And like I said, he could put you over, but also he knew how to cut you down. And a lot of them didn't know that they were being cut down until they got back to the dressing room, and they say, whoa, he just tore me up, and I didn't even know it. He was that type of guy. But I liked him. I liked him real well, and I respect them, and they respected me. So that's bottom line. That's what it's all about.
You're very, very well respected, and it's been such an honor, Phil, for you to be on our show and podcast this morning. We can't thank you enough, man. We really can't.
Well, it's an honor for me, and like I said, you guys are the first interview that I've given since I retired. And so it's an honor for me that y'all felt good enough for me to be on your show. Absolutely. And like I said, I'm honored.
Well, it's the pleasure and the honor has been all ours, sir.
Do what?
I said the pleasure and the honor has been ours, has been all ours. Thank you so much.
Okay. I thank you guys. And, hey, have a great season, and keep them going.
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much. Talk to you soon, Phil.
Okay. Thanks, buddy.
All right.
Thanks, buddy. Bye-bye.
All right.